Thomas and myself, but you are right to say that I offered you an introduction, and I mean to stand by my word. Instantly I saw my chance. Then you would support me in obtaining a manservant from him? I said. His eyes opened wide. So you are indeed looking to purchase? I am, I said. I don't believe I have a choice. In these past weeks, whenever I've ventured out in the fields, I've seen that if I am to work in this heat, I will need assistance, especially when I consider further travel. I was thinking a younger boy, one easier to train. Perhaps in town. In 2 weeks' time, there is an auction. No, I would like to purchase a boy as soon as possible. But from Thomas? Yes, why not? It will give me time to train him before I leave. You were thinking of leaving us? He asked. Certainly that day is coming, I hedged. Be assured that your time here is not measured. Your presence in our home has benefited this family in many ways. This has been more difficult than I expected. Mrs. Spencer was everything. His voice thickened with tears. I understand, I said, and did not tell him how I grieved at night for Caroline. He blew his nose. I only want you to know that you need not rush away. If you feel that you need an assistant for your work while you are here with us, we can see about obtaining someone for you within the week. Are you of the mind, then, that Mr. Thomas would be open to a sale? Bill Thomas continually buys from auctions, and if they don't settle in, he sells again to the traders who stop by his place when they're heading down into the lower states. Some, including myself, as you know, have bought from him, though he commands a high price. It is settled, then. When would you suggest we make our visit? I suppose that tomorrow is as good a day as any. We will go early to avoid the heat, and with some luck, we will return with your man. I felt almost lightheaded with relief and fear.
Chapter 33 1830. Pan. I'm pouring out a slop bucket the day the two white men who bring in the runners show up again. I get inside quick, but they follow me in, and the one with no front teeth grabs hold of my ear so hard that my eyes get watery. Look at her crying for her mama, he says. I want to tell him that I'm not crying, but I know to keep quiet. His head looks better, but he still ain't worth nothing, says the other one, who's poking at my head. When's that trader coming through? Sometime in the next couple of weeks. Good. Looks like Suki put him to work. We'll keep him in here till then. Suki, he calls across the room. You got enough work to keep this one busy for another couple of weeks? Suki gives a nod, but looks away again, like she don't have no time for me. After the men go, I walk around all day wondering what to do. What if they take me from this place before Mr. Burton gets here? And why don't he come? I know my daddy don't come because they take him for a slave, but why don't Mr. Burton come? After a while, I get so worked up that I can't eat, and I got to go lay on my bed. That night, Suki already got on her nightdress when she comes out of her room and waves at me. I follow her into her room, wondering what's going on, because she never does this before. She grabs down the slate board hooked to the wall and then points for me to sit on the edge of her bed. After she puts the lantern on the table, she grabs a small rag from a desk and sits beside me. "We getting you out," she writes. And as soon as I read it, she spits on the rag and wipes it off the slate. "What do you mean?" I get so excited I stand up. She puts a finger to her lips and waves me down again. She stands up and goes to the door to look out. When she sees that everything is quiet, she comes back with a finger at her mouth. "What do you mean?" I whisper. "That you gonna get me home?" She nods. It feels like the sun come up inside me. "How? How will you do that?" I ask. "Some runners coming through and you go with them." She spits again and wipes the words away. Chicken skin comes up all over my arms and the back of my neck. "Runners?" I whisper. She looks at me, deep, and then nods. "Do you know them?" I ask. She shakes her head. "We just know that they need our help. She writes so fast that I hardly have time to read before she erases. "Does that mean I'll be a runner?" I ask. She nods. I can't help it. I stare up at her. "What happens if they catch us?" I ask. She nods to the other room, and I know what she means. By now, I understand what they do to runners. "They're gonna sell me away if I stay here, right?" I ask. She nods again. "Then I wanna go," I whisper. "But I'm so scared I got to pee." "You got to do what they say." "I will," I agree. "They catch you, you can't say nothing about who helped you." I don't need to be told that if I am caught and they find out Suki helped me, they would hurt her as bad as me. I shake my head. "I'd never tell on you." She does something she never done before. Puts her hand round my shoulders and gives a squeeze. It feels good. Now I just got to ask. "Suki?" I say.
"Oh,"
she grunts, real quiet. "Can't you talk?" I ask her. She shakes her head. "Didn't your mama teach you how to talk?" She looks at me like she wants to say something, but instead she opens her mouth big and points inside. It takes me a while to figure out that her tongue is gone. My stomach flops over when I think about her having no tongue. Where'd it go? I look around the room trying to think of something to say. Then it comes to me. "Why don't you come too?" I ask. She takes my hand and holds it on her big belly. Quick, though, I pull back when I feel something in there bump at my hand. "It's moving," I say. And even though I'm still thinking about her tongue, I can't help but smile at her stomach. I touch it again. "You got a baby in there," I whisper. But then I see she's crying. I wait for a while before I ask, "Don't you want this baby?" She shakes her head. I look up at her because I wonder what kind of mama don't want her baby. Then I'm thinking that she won't need to spit no more to clean the slate because of how wet she's getting the rag by wiping at her face. "Why not? Don't you like babies?" I finally say when she stops. "They sell them," she writes, crying at the same time. I don't know what to do, because I never see her like this. "Don't cry, Suki," I say, and put my arm up around her shoulders as far as I can reach. "After I get to Mr. Burton's, we'll come back for you and this baby." She sends me back to bed then and closes the door to her room. In the morning, her eyes is all puffed out. I feel bad for talking about her babies and making her cry, but mostly I'm too scared to worry about her. During the night, I remember that sometimes they shoot the runners.
Chapter 34. 1830. Suki. We hear there's a strong runner coming up from Georgia. He's been through before and didn't make it. But those that try again got a better chance because they know more of the places to find help. I'm sending Pan off with him because that traitor's coming through. And who knows what will happen to him then. I'm making the boy carry out slop pails and work his legs whenever I got the chance. And I see he's getting stronger. But we don't have much time left. Pan reminds me of my own boys. Maybe because he's so full of questions like my own used to be. "Mama, why this? Mama, why that?" He's sweet, too, like my boys was. Trouble is, worrying about what's going to happen to Pan makes me wonder where my own boys got to. After the old couple die and they take Nate away, they sell me and my boys to a new place. It looks like the farm I grew up at, but this one is easy 5 times the size of Miss Lavinia's home. Here, there's also a mistress in the big house, but I never see her. Her 3 children are all away at school, and from what I know, she is most often away herself. They put me in with Hester, a woman who is head of the kitchen house. 3 overseers run the place, and from what Hester tells me, I got to be careful of them, because they don't stop at nothing. They live down by the quarters and don't bother with the big house or the kitchen house unless there's a problem they have to work out. At this farm, they grow cotton. But for the field workers, it's all the same. Cotton or tobacco, hard work is hard work, and nobody here gets finished without knowing there's plenty more behind it. The master of this place I see only two times. The first time I'm working in the kitchen house, putting up peas with Hester, when he stops by with an overseer to look at me. He asks me if I have any questions and if I know the rules. "Yes, sir," is all I say, and that seems enough for him. The second time I see him is after they take my boys. They was good boys, but they was only 5 years old when they took us from the preacher's place. After a couple of months living at the new place, they start fussing at me to take them back home to find their daddy. I can't keep watch over them 'cause I'm working in the kitchen house, and during the day, they are looked after down in the quarters. At night, they come back to me, but then they keep pestering me, "Where's their daddy, and why don't I take them home?" They even cry for the old woman and the preacher man. They tell me they don't like staying down at the quarters. The other boys fight rough, they say, and if I don't take them to find their daddy, they're going to go without me. I get scared and tell them about the patrollers out there and what they do to small colored boys if they find them out on the road. I don't hold back and I scare them enough so they stay put, but soon after, they start getting into trouble. With another boy, they break into the spring house and help themselves to milk and a whole kettle of pudding. They's lucky that Hester is the one who finds them, even though she paddles them hard. "You best get those two in line before they put them out in the fields," Hester tells me. She only has a girl, a little one, Clara, who is easygoing, so Hester don't know what I'm up against. I tell her, maybe she don't know how hard it is to raise up those two on my own. "Don't you go getting on me," she says. "I'm just trying to do right by you. Those boys of yours need shaping up, and you don't want the overseers on this place doing the job for you." I know she's right, but I don't know what to do. I talk to them again, but they cry and say they want their daddy back, and they want me to go find him. I get mad and say they can't talk about him no more. He gone, and that's the way it is. They get quiet and stay that way, because they never do see me cry before. I'm glad to go to work in the morning, because when I'm working hard, I have no time to think. I like to cook, but I miss working outside in the gardens like I did at the preacher's house. Here, the vegetable gardens are the biggest and best I ever seen, but Hester warns me against going in. She tells me that Emma is in charge of the gardens, and nobody crosses Emma. She says on a good day, Emma isn't friendly, but on a bad day, even the overseers watch out for her. "Truth is," Hester says, "Emma don't have no scare left in her. She even takes on the men that are beating on their women. She goes right on up to them. 'You want a fight?' she says. Then she lands a good one. Everybody says she's crazy taking on the men like that." The day Hester spilled a pot of stew on her foot, she screamed so loud that I didn't wait but took off running, pulling her with me down to the slave sick house. There old Tony, who runs the place as good as any white doctor, came to help us right quick. After he got a good look, he called across the room to a big woman who was standing next to a shelf of glass jars. "Emma, bring the medicine in the blue jar," he calls. When the woman came over, old Tony points her toward Hester. "Put some of that on that burn," he says, then goes to help out a woman a few beds down who's having a hard time with bringing in a baby. Emma sits down, big and heavy as a stone, and I try not to stare. The woman was ugly looking. There's no other way to put it. With her eyes bulging out and no eyelashes and no eyebrows, with hands as big as a man's and nail beds twice the size of normal. She spread the herb grease over Hester's burn, and when she's done, I help her wrap a clean rag around the foot. Hester feels a whole lot better with the grease and cloth taking the air off the burn. A couple of weeks after Hester's burn is cleared up, Emma comes up to the kitchen house, looking to talk to me.
They tell me to take somebody from up here to help out old Tony in the sick house, and when he don't need you, you can help me out in the gardens. You was good with Hester, so I'm taking you.
You sure you got to have her? Hester asked. She's working out here with the cooking real good.
They told me to get somebody from up here, and I'm picking her,
Emma says, then leaves the kitchen house with me standing there. You best go, Hester says. Emma gets what she wants. Just stay out of her way and do what she says. So that's how I start working with Emma. Some days we work the garden, some days I work with old Tony. It just depends on who needs what the most. I move my things down to a room off of Emma's hut, and the boys come there to sleep at night. But they don't like it, 'cause they was just getting used to sleeping at the kitchen house. The man that lives with Emma comes in and out, but I don't ever hear them saying two words to each other. I'm guessing he's the daddy of the baby she has. Right from the start, I don't like Emma for the way she don't take care of it. The only thing I see her do is give it her milk. Seems like the baby cries all day. I'm not there 2 days when I can't take it no more. I don't care what Emma's going to say. I go pick up that baby and clean him up good. And after that, I take it on myself to see that he stays clean. I get some grease from old Tony and put it on that baby boy's sore bottom. And after that, he don't cry as much.
Why you do that? She asks when she sees me cleaning his bottom. He just dirted himself again.
But I remember what it feels like to have that dried on you and to have it stinging sore. It ain't right to let babies feel that, and I tell her so. The first time I sing to that child of hers, Emma look at me like she gonna grab that baby away. Instead, she goes stomping off, but she don't stop me. I never know a mama like this who don't have no feelings for her own baby. One day when Emma and me is sitting beside the house and shelling beans, real careful, I ask her why she don't care nothing about her baby. She turns her head at me, her eyes half closed, and shoots me a mean look. I don't look back at her. I just keep shelling.
They gonna get them anyway, she say. Sides, I don't like babies. The only baby I ever cared for was my first one. She was 4 years when they took her. She was nothing like me. She was little and never did nothing but laugh. 4 years old, and she talked like she was a grown woman. When they took her, I was working the fields. When I come back, she was gone. Nothing I could do about it except have the one I was carrying. Now don't ask me no more.
I don't ask her no more, but I still take care of her baby. In time I start to notice that she stops leaving him by himself and brings him along in his basket to wherever I'm working, so when he fusses, I'll go to him. Then one day, after she's talking to some others down in the quarters, she comes stomping over to me.
I's hearing that your boys is trouble. You best watch out. They send them off if you don't get hold of them.
First, I think to tell her that my boys is none of her business, but I think better of it and keep quiet. That night, I sit them down and try to talk to them. When they start sassing back, I know that I got to paddle them. When the moon comes up, all three of us are crying ourselves to sleep. In the morning, both of those boys is curled up next to me. I kiss their baby hands that still got some fat on them. I know about the God and the old preacher's Bible, but I'm thinking maybe he only looks out for white folks. I talk to him anyway and ask for his help. The boys are 7 years old the summer they are put to work bringing water to those in the fields. A couple of weeks in, I don't know what went wrong. Maybe one got to sassing and the other one stood up for him. But that night, they both come back with a beating. Monday afternoon of the next week, Emma comes running up from the quarters to tell me they are sold and the car is heading out. I run, but when I get there, they are gone and dust is all I see. I run down the road and when I think I hear them calling for me, I start screaming for them. One of the overseers gets a hold of me.
"Stop your screaming,"
he say, but I can't. Two overseers got a hold of me, pulling me back, but that don't stop me. Some of the workers from the field stop their work and are walking over, carrying their hose. Then a couple of the women start calling out for them to let go of me. One of the overseers shoots his gun up in the air and tells them to get back to the field. I still yelling for my boys, and they pull me back behind the quarters, where one of the men knocks me down, stands over me, and tells me to shut up, shut up. When the other one starts kicking me, it's like he's lighting a fire, and something lets loose in me. I jump up, I go after the first one, catch hold of his hand and bite down, his blood tasting good in my mouth. He gets loose and I grab hold of a stick, then I go after the other one. I run at his face and before he can stop me, I get it into his eye. All the while I'm calling out for Nate, Nate, Nate. Why I start yelling for him after all this time, I don't know. Maybe something in me knows that I never get to say his name again. 'Cause after they tie me up, they take my tongue. First I get lost in the pain. Then I get lost in the fever. The master comes, takes a look, and Emma say he's not happy about what's been done, but it's too late to fix it. For a couple of weeks my mind don't know where it's at. After the fever passes, Hester and Emma get me up walking, and slow but sure, those two bring me round. Emma gets me to drink a mix that softens the burn, but I choke on it because I don't know how to drink with no tongue. After I start keeping the drinks down, in the next days, Emma comes to me with mashed sweet potato. She steps back when I bring it up. That night she comes with more. This time, the sweet potato got molasses. It takes a long time to work it down 'cause every swallow makes me feel like it's going to get stuck. One night, I figure out that I can die if I don't let no food stay down. But Emma works so hard to get it in me that I wait for her to go before I bring it up again. And that's what I do every time Emma leaves. Until one night she catches on. I lay down and make like I's going to sleep so Emma will leave. But instead, she comes over to my pallet.
"Scoot over,"
she says, then lays down beside me.
"I'm gonna stay the night."
What's she doing, I wonder. We lay there looking at each other.
"You got to cry, girl," she says.
I look at her real long. I don't feel like crying. I don't feel nothing but that my babies are gone and there's a fire in my mouth. Besides, what's Emma doing telling me to cry? If there's one woman on this place who don't cry, it's Emma. Everybody knows that. So Emma and me just lay there looking at each other. She takes a rag to wipe my mouth. I'm still so sore that I don't know there's spit and maybe some blood dripping out the side. I close my eyes, hoping she will go so I can throw up the potato.
"Sook," she say real soft, but I keep my eyes closed like I'm sleeping. "Sookie," she say again. You got to live, girl. They never should have done this to you. What my baby boy gonna do if you gone? When I hear a noise like she's choking, I open my eyes. I never hear that sound coming out of her. Then I see her whole face is wet, and I know she's crying the best she remembers how. My arms feel like logs, but I reach over and take the rag she got and wipe down her face. More choking sounds come from Emma until her whole body is wet and shaking like she got a bad fever. So I put my arms round her like she one of my babies. I hold her like that till we both fall asleep. In the morning, I get up when she's sleeping, her eyes swollen bad as one of the times she's been drinking and fighting. I get myself up and go to old Tony and let him know that I need 2 cups of his healing tea. I take them back and give one to Emma. She don't say nothing when we drink it together. But since that day, we watch out for each other. And when she needs to, Emma does the talking for me. I work in the garden, but more and more old Tony needs me to help out in his hospital. He starts teaching me about the herbs that will help in the healing, which ones do what, and when I start to write down the mixes, he sees that I can read and write, and it's not long before I find out that he can do the same. On the day I find out where my boys is at, someplace down in Georgia, I set it in my mind to go find them. A few nights later, I try running, but I don't get far before they catch me. They give me a lashing that puts me down for a couple of weeks, and they tell me I go again, they kill me. Maybe a year goes by before one of the field men, drunk, gets a hold of me and takes me back of the barns. First I fight, but when it gets rough, I just let him finish up. He catches me 2 more times before I write a note to old Tony. He goes to Emma, and that night the man who's bothering me gets to know what Emma's like when she's not happy. When I start showing a baby, Emma shakes her head, then puts her arm around my shoulders and says not to worry. She'll help me when the time comes. Don't give him a name, Emma says when the baby shows up. But in my head, I call him Nate. After that, I take care of him right along with Emma's boy, before they move the boys down to the quarters and then sell them off. The day they go, Emma does a fighting for me. She goes too far, and the beating that she gets should have done her in. But Hester and me bring her through. After that time, the 3 of us watch out for each other, until the day when Hester and her girl Clara and me get sold up here to Southwood Plantation. They don't buy Emma. At Southwood, they need somebody to run their new hospital, so they put me in there thinking I know more than I do. I don't say otherwise. Lucky for me, I got all of old Tony's medicines writ down. It don't seem to bother nobody that I can read and write, and they like that I don't talk. There's a man at Southwood who right from the start was good to me. When he got the fever, I treated him, and after he got back on his feet, we get together, and he the daddy of this baby. It takes some time before he lets me know that he helps colored folk that are running, and it don't take long before I'm helping him out. He got a big job on this place, heads up some of the field workers. The 2 of us talk about running one day, but we know we can't go together. They track us till we was dead. Almost every time another runner comes through, my man says, Suki girl, you want to take this chance? You go. But even though I want this baby free, I guess I'm just too scared. Where am I gonna go? I used to think I could try to find my way back to Virginia and Miss Lavinia at Tall Oaks. But then
Master Marshall would just sell me again. Even if I never get away, I feel good helping others make it out. We never know for sure when the next bunch of runners is coming through. Sometimes it's only one. Sometimes four or five. One more scared than the next. But that don't stop them. I keep hoping that one of these times Emma or maybe even one of my boys is going to come through.
Chapter 35 1830 James. It was already June. The Monday morning we set out for Southwood. I used great care to dress, taking it upon myself to polish my tall brown boots and brush out my best dark brown jacket. Hester provided me with a clean and pressed white shirt and cravat, and before donning it, I gave myself a close shave. As I patted on my bay rum, I peered into my traveling case mirror and was relieved to see that wearing a hat had served its purpose, and the sun had not affected my complexion. Surprisingly, Adelaide joined us at the morning table, dressed prettily in a pale green riding costume. When she announced her decision to accompany us, her father first objected, but she pouted in the way he could not resist, and with a shrug meant for me, he gave his assent. In fact, I was happy to have her along, thinking she might prove an added distraction if anyone looked me over too carefully. The horse provided me was a gray thoroughbred. I was anxious to leave and did not use the mounting stone, but made the leap up onto the horse's back.
"You see, Father, that is how it is done," Adelaide nodded at me approvingly.
"Well, maybe if I were 10 years younger and a few pounds lighter," Mr. Spencer said, patting his round stomach, but he did not smile at her as usual, and I realized then how tense he was. In fact, he appeared as anxious as I felt. All I desired was to get hold of Pan and to leave this place. I had my purse in the saddlebag, and with any luck, by tomorrow, Pan and I would be on our way up to Williamsburg. There I could only hope that Robert and my daughter safely awaited my arrival. Adelaide chattered merrily as the three of us rode together toward our destination. But as we approached the drive leading up to Southwood, my horse shied, setting off skittish behavior with the other two horses. "I'm afraid these horses haven't been worked in a while. Use a heavy hand if you must," Mr. Spencer directed. "Here, Addie, let me take your reins," he said as she worked to calm her horse.
"No, Father,"
she said, using her crop to take command, while glancing at me to see if I noted her accomplished riding skills. As we approached Southwood, we moved our horses out of the brutal sun and into the shade of the tall cedars that lined the long drive. Past the trees on either side lay open fields with workers bent over vegetation. We were approaching one of the largest cotton plantations in this northern Carolina region. I looked about hopefully, wondering if I might see Pan out in the fields, but my horse, sensitive to my nerves, began to sidestep. "Use your crop," Mr. Spencer instructed, but I knew the problem was with me and not the horse. "He'll be fine. He'll settle down. How many acres do they have in cotton?" I asked as a means of distraction. "That is a question you might ask Thomas," Mr. Spencer said, his attention on his own spirited horse. The night before, Mr. Spencer had warned me to tread carefully with Bill Thomas. My host explained that for years Thomas had complete run of Southwood, and the absentee owners relied on him exclusively. No one in the area could dispute that this was one of the most efficiently run plantations, and that the cotton production was enviable. However, Mr. Spencer said, Bill Thomas is a man who runs his place by his own rules. I knew what he insinuated, for I remembered Tall Oaks and the absolute control Rankin had enjoyed. His actions were seldom, if ever, influenced by the law, and as a result, he was ruthless. The first building that came into view was a fair-sized clapboard house set at the head of the drive. It had a balcony protruding from the second floor, a place where a man might observe all of the many buildings under his jurisdiction. I was not surprised to learn that it was Bill Thomas's home. A wide brick path was laid parallel to the drive, and both ran up and past a row of neatly constructed whitewashed buildings. Farther down, the two trails divided, and while the road wound around to the right, the brick path turned left toward a handsome house set in the center of a heavily treed garden. This house, too, was white-painted clapboard, but it was easily four times the size of the first, and from it protruded three large balconies. From atop my horse, I could see the entire plantation laid out on flat terrain, with a river at the far end creating a natural boundary. A good distance from the main house, set back from the riverbank, was an extended row of small but orderly gray cabins that constituted the quarters. Another boundary was set to the left of the house by a canal that intersected with the river and traveled down the property out and away as far as I could see. I later learned that this waterway was used to transport the cotton via a series of rivers and other canals that wound their way down to Edenton. We stopped in front of the manager's home, and before Mr. Spencer had time to dismount, a woman came to the door. Although she was white, her faded homespun dress, worn face, and disheveled hair alerted one to the fact that she was not a woman of leisure. She dried her hands with a rag, then tossed it over her shoulder as she squinted at us. "You looking for Bill?" she asked in a hard voice. Not waiting for a reply, she pointed toward the big house. "He's up there working on something, but he don't have no time for sitting around talking." "We've come on business," Mr. Spencer answered. "You'll just have to go on up then. Ask any of the niggas you see where he is. They'll tell you." My horse was prancing and so agitated that I decided to dismount. "Give him the crop," Mr. Spencer directed, but my feet were already on the ground. "I'll straighten him out tomorrow," I answered. "We might as well join you on foot." Mr. Spencer slipped down from his horse and handed me the reins, thereby freeing himself to assist his daughter. "I'll get Alfred from the barn to take your horses," the woman said. Without warning, she put her fingers to her mouth and gave a shrill whistle for help. Addie was preparing for dismount when her horse, startled by the whistle, jumped back. Addie tossed forward, flew through the air, and landed hard on the brick path. With her scream of pain, her father rushed to her side. As Mr. Spencer helped her stand, her face went white. "Daddy," she cried, clutching at her arm and falling against him. "Daddy, my arm!" He scooped her up and frantically looked about. The woman hesitated, but then opened the door of her home and waved the two of them in before she looked back at me. "Give Alfred your horses," she said, nodding toward the newly arrived servant. "Then go on to that building up there, the sick house, the one with the glass windows. Get Suki. She's a nigga, but good as any doctor hereabouts." I did as directed and moved swiftly past the washhouse yard where women boiled and scrubbed and slapped at the air with wet laundry. Though concerned for Addie, I hadn't forgotten Pan as I hurried up the road. I glanced into the next building, where the door stood open, and inside a lone woman clanked away at a room-sized loom. I kept moving, and in the shade of the loom house, I startled a group of women who looked up, grim-faced, from their spinning. I greeted them with a nod, but they did not respond. This might have been a peaceful scene, but something was amiss. Unsettled by their silence, concerned about Addie, and growing more desperate to get a glimpse of Pan, I left the drive to cut through a yard and found myself at the back of the cooper's shop. I brushed past some dozen or so newly constructed wooden barrels, and rounded the building so quickly that I almost tripped over the cooper. The man worked like one possessed. Wood shavings flew as perspiration dripped from his face, and even as I greeted him, he didn't take note of me. Then I saw why. In front of him, in the center of the workyard, sat a type of stockade. There, seated on a thin wedge of board, a nude Negro man was locked into a wooden contraption. With his feet tied straight out and his hands secured behind him, he had nothing to support his back. The pain of the wood cutting into his buttocks must have been unbearable. Added to his torture were the scorching sun and the clouds of flies and mosquitoes that surrounded him. His head lolled to the side and his eyes were glazed with pain, while his breathing came in short, guttural grunts. Because of his location, all of the yard workers were witness to his torment, yet almost certainly were forbidden to do anything to relieve his suffering. I stared, sickened, before turning away. I ran then toward the building with glass panes and rapped heavily on the door. When there was no response, I pushed in and closed the door behind me. My breathing finally quieted as I looked about the sparsely furnished hallway, and when I heard voices, I followed the sound through another door. The large room I entered had at least 20 pallets lining the walls, and though most were empty, it was built to serve this community of more than 200 slaves. The floorboards creaked when I stepped across the doorsill. A young boy, assisting a Negro woman who was caring for a patient, turned at the sound of my entry. He stared for only a moment before he dropped the wooden bowl he held.
"Mr. Burton! Mr. Burton!"
he called out as he ran toward me.
"I knew you'd come for me! I knew you'd come for me!"
He clutched at my waist, his whole body trembling. It was difficult to believe that this sad, emaciated boy was Pan. As I patted his shorn head, I felt the long, jagged scar. What had they done to this gentle boy? How had he been so badly injured? In those moments, my fear for myself turned to rage for this child. I wanted to snatch him and go, but after what I had already seen, I knew that now more than ever, I needed to hold myself in check. I had been warned that this place was governed by its own law, and guards were likely everywhere. All eyes were on us as I pried Pan loose, then set him back and looked directly into his eyes. "Listen to me," I said, speaking as low as I could. "Do not say another word. You must not address me, do you understand?" I held both of his frail shoulders and looked into his eyes. "Your leaving here will depend on this." He nodded, but he reached for my hand again as though for reassurance. "No," I said, pulling back. "You must go back to work." I turned him around, then directed him toward the large homely woman who watched silently. "I'm looking for Suki," I said. Pan pointed to her.
"That is Suki, Mr. Burton."
"Pan, do not use my name." The boy's shoulders slumped.
"I'm sorry,"
he said, his eyes enormous and his drawn face. I forced my attention away from him. "Are you Suki?" I asked the woman. She nodded, then slowly came forward as she readjusted her faded head wrap and smoothed out her brown skirt. She was a heavyset woman with plain features, and as she approached me, her black eyes kept darting to my eye patch.
"She can't talk," Pan said.
"Tell her that she is needed at Mr. Thomas's house," I said.
"She can hear, she just can't talk,"
said Pan when the woman shot me a look. Did she mean the boy harm? Would she tell Thomas what she had seen the boy do? I wanted to ask her for help, but she moved quickly. As I left, I glanced back at Pan and put my finger to my lips, reminding him of silence. His eyes sparkled when he nodded his understanding. By the time we reached Thomas's house, he had come and gone and the doctor had been sent for. It appeared Addie's arm was broken, and the decision to take her up to a bedroom in the big house had been made. When Mr. Spencer requested that I go to fetch Hester so she might attend to Addie, I could not ride out fast enough, wanting only to head for the north. But I had found Pan, and now I only had to extricate him.
Chapter 36. 1830. James. Addie was to remain at Southwood for 7 days. Her arm had been set, and though it was a clean break, the doctor insisted that she not be moved. She was made as comfortable as possible in a guest room of the big house. Following her first day of confinement, Mr. Spencer returned from seeing her and called me into his study. "Hester will remain with Addie for the duration of her stay. I will spend the mornings with her and go back every evening, but I need some time in the afternoon to see to my work. I realize this might be considered unusual, but I wonder if I might ask you to visit with her in the afternoons. I can't say that I like to leave her and Hester alone on the place without someone to oversee to their welfare. Perhaps you would be willing to check in with her and read to her for an hour or so?" "I would be happy to do so," I said, feeling some obligation, but also realizing the access it provided me to Southwood. As though reading my thoughts, Mr. Spencer continued on. "I know you want to get yourself a man," he said, "but I'm asking that you wait until Addie is back home. Thomas's moods are too unreliable, and I'd like Addie out of there if you decide to carry through with a purchase." "Certainly," I said, and though frustrated with his request, I thought it best not to press my need. When I visited the following afternoon, I found Addie sitting up in a chair with Hester by her side. "How well you are doing. It is wonderful to see you sitting in a chair," I said.
"It's my first time up. I almost fainted," she said with some pride. "It was fortunate that Hester's friend Suki was here to help catch me."
I looked at Hester. "She is your friend?" Hester promptly busied herself straightening the bed cover.
"They came to this place together," Addie said. "Isn't that true, Hester?"
Hester kept her attention on the red quilt that she was smoothing.
"We know each other a long time," she said.
"Hester won't tell me why Suki won't speak,"
Addie complained. There was an awkward silence in the room.
"I don't talk about that,"
Hester finally said.
"All I want to know is why she won't talk,"
Addie argued.
"She just can't, is all," Hester said.
"Does she not like me, or is that the way she is with everyone?"
Addie asked. "She don't talk to nobody," said Hester.
"But why won't she?"
Addie persisted.
"'Cause she can't,"
Hester said, her tone of voice issuing a warning that Addie disregarded.
"But why won't you tell me, Hester?" she pushed.
"That none of your business," Hester said in a voice so harsh that the girl sat back in surprise. When Addie's eyes watered, Hester spoke more gently.
"Miss Addie, I don't mean to talk to you like that. I'm just wanting you to get better so we can get home, is all. I don't like being back at this place."
Addie was ready to take advantage of the opportunity.
"All I wanted to know was why that woman won't talk to me,"
she said, actually sounding contrite. Hester looked at me helplessly before she turned back to Addie.
"She won't talk 'cause she can't. They take out her tongue."
In the heat of the room, a chill traveled the length of my body. Addie's mouth opened and then closed again.
"I want to go back to bed,"
she said weakly. I honored Mr. Spencer's request and returned to visit with Addie over the next couple of days. On my way to the big house, I passed by the hospital where I knew Pan waited, though I dared not make contact with him. I struggled with fear for my own safety and continually fought myself over wanting to make a quick escape on my own. But then I would recall the knotty feel of the long scar on Pan's head that marked his abuse, and fury would renew my resolve. As soon as Addie was home, I would meet with Thomas and offer a purse he could not refuse. On Thursday afternoon, I was with Addie longer than usual and stayed to play chess with her until her doctor arrived. It seemed he would never come, but when he finally did, I made my exit. It was then, while hurrying down the back porch steps, that I met Bill Thomas for the first time. Thomas was a tall man, and his stride corresponded to the length of his legs. Had I met him in a public square, I might have given him notice, for he was a strikingly handsome man who carried himself with an authority that reflected undisputed power. Clothed in various shades of brown, he wore a low-slung leather belt from which hung a handgun and, next to it, a treacherous-looking sheathed knife. He nodded in my direction but would have kept on walking had I not stepped out in his path.
"Good day," I greeted him.
"And who are you?"
he asked. "My name is James Burton. I'm an artist, and I am visiting with the Spencers."
"I see," he said.
"And you are Bill Thomas?" I asked in a friendly voice, for he did not appear the brute I had expected. He nodded, then looked toward the house.
"How's the girl?"
"She appears to be doing well," I said. "I believe that we will be able to take her home soon."
"Sooner the better," he said.
I duly noted the cold comment, but saw an opportunity and took it. "I've been wanting to meet you," I said.
"And why's that?"
"As I mentioned earlier, I am an artist here to paint birds for the museum in Philadelphia."
"What's that got to do with me?"
he asked. I mustered as optimistic a tone as I could. "I was hoping to solicit your help. Since my arrival, I have come to realize that I will be needing some assistance when I am out in the field. I specifically need someone to tote my supplies and help me out when I travel, as I foolishly left my valet at home. This summer heat is more brutal than I expected, but your Negroes seem to be able to tolerate it well." He grunted. "I thought I might be able to purchase a young man from you," I added quickly. He smirked.
"I thought you people up there didn't believe in paying money for Negroes."
Not everyone thinks along those lines, I said.
Uh-huh, he said. So what are you wanting from me?
When I was down in your hospital the other day, I saw a young boy who I thought might work out, I said. Made uncomfortable by his stare, I glanced toward the building. He waited for me to turn back.
And which one is that? He asked.
I tried to sound as offhand as I could. He's small, thin, but I didn't get his name. He was helping that Suki woman out.
Ah, him. Got him a couple months back. Sickly. Isn't broke in yet.
I'm hoping you'll sell him to me. He's of the age I was considering, and he won't be expected to do much heavy work. I'm prepared to pay.
He'd cost, that's for sure.
Just give me a number, I said, and knew that I sounded too eager. Thomas eyed me as I removed my hat to wipe my forehead dry.
I have a couple others that might work out, he said.
I knew this ploy, for I had seen this same strategy applied when trading for a horse. He meant to get a feel for how determined I was to buy this particular boy. I had no desire to haggle over price. Pan, I caught myself, but not before he noted it. I believe the boy's name is Pan, I said, my chest tightening as I realized my mistake. I think that's what the woman Suki called him. No, it couldn't have been her. She doesn't speak, does she? I hastily sought to recover. It's unimportant. All I need to know is how much you want for him. Thomas leaned over and snapped off a tall blade of grass, then put it between his teeth and began to chew. He looked me over, then spat out the grass.
I'll see you another time, he said. I got some thinking to do.
As he turned away, so sure of his position, dark fury shot through me. How dare he dismiss me as though I were one of his Negroes? He had no sooner disappeared than a pebble struck the back of my head. I swung around to see Suki peering out from the corner of the house. She waved me over, and as soon as I rounded the house, she pulled out a slate and began to write.
You Jamie Pike?
I was so startled that I thought I had misread the words. I reread them. I had not. She quickly erased the board with her skirt and scratched out,
I am Suki, Tall Oaks.
My stomach dropped, and my mouth went slack as I stepped back. What did she mean? Surely it wasn't possible. Was she trying to say that she, this aged, worn woman, was Lavinia's favored servant from Tall Oaks? And if she was, how had she so easily recognized me? I stared at her, searching her face, while she scrawled again.
Get Pan out, the slate read.
I forced myself to stop staring at her. I will, I said. I'm going to buy him. She shook her head violently.
Trader coming for him, she wrote.
I'm arranging to get him, I repeated, wondering if her hearing was impaired as well as her speech. She was about to write something more, but when two Negro men rounded the corner, the startled woman fled. My horse had free rein, and as he galloped for home, my mind raced. I fought to control my rising panic. What had Suki meant when she said that a trader was coming? How soon, and was he coming just for Pan? And what of Suki? She was older than I, and my memories from Tall Oaks were vague, but I recalled well the terrifying day when she had been sold. What were her memories of me? And if she knew of my lineage, would she use it against me to benefit herself? Perhaps it would be best if I tried to buy her along with Pan. But Thomas was already suspicious. What if I were to approach him from another angle and state that both Pan and Suki had been stolen from me? But I had nothing to offer as proof. And I understood the man well enough to know that if he suspected my desire, he would refuse me. I had already made that error. Because of it, I worried that I had already jeopardized the sale of Pan. My horse whinnied at an approaching gig. I reined him to the side of the road as Mr. Spencer and Patricia wheeled up.
I cried until Daddy said he would take me to see Addie,
Patricia called out happily. Mr. Spencer glanced at me with a sheepish grin.
You have two letters waiting for you. Sam went into town today and had just returned with the mail, he said.
Finally, some word from Robert.
Wonderful, I said. Though hesitant to let him know that I had gone against his wishes, I brought up my meeting with Bill Thomas. As I explained our exchange, Mr. Spencer lost his pleasant look. "I'm sorry for not waiting," I quickly added. "But the meeting was so fortuitous that I felt I had to take advantage of it."
"And does Thomas have a man for you?"
"There is a young boy I have seen around. He works with that woman Suki in the hospital. He is the one I want."
Mr. Spencer looked at me curiously. "I see," he said. "And Thomas has agreed to the purchase?"
"Not yet," I said. "I'm afraid he's taken a dislike to me. I wonder if you might put a good word in for me."
He frowned and shook his head. "Once Thomas decides something, nothing will convince him otherwise. He is that way in all matters and believes himself above the law. Unfortunately," he looked over at Patricia and thought better of what he was about to say, "my suggestion is to let it go. And we will go to an auction next week. There are plenty of others for sale. The thing is, I have settled on this one boy. He would be perfect for my needs, and I'm thinking of purchasing that Suki woman, too. She seems to know a lot about..."
"Forget about her. She runs that hospital for him, and he isn't about to let her go. I say to forget about the boy as well."
"But he is the one I want," I argued. He leaned toward me, and though his voice was quiet, it was deep and commanding.
"Listen to me. Thomas is not a man to fool with. There is a lot of swampland in these parts, and you would not be the first to go missing after a disagreement with him." With that, he slapped the reins and put a quick end to our conversation. When I found the two letters addressed to me on a tray in the front entry, I took them directly to the privacy of my room. The first letter I opened was from Robert.
"Dear Mr. Burton, we arrived safely in Williamsburg and have been well received by both Miss Madden and Miss Pike. Rest assured that your daughter is cared for and in good health. Though the Philadelphia house has not yet been sold, I have hired a reliable caretaker, and Molly will stay on until such time as the sale takes place. As per your request, your lawyer has seen to the transfer of your monies to Williamsburg, and I have included a record of what has been spent to date. I have been as judicious with expenditures as possible. I await your safe return and remain a devoted servant to both you and your daughter. Robert."
Satisfied to learn that the baby and Robert were safe, I tore open the second letter.
"Dear Mr. Burton, how surprising it was to receive your letter. Your lineage in this family is well known, and because of it, Aunt Meg's mother, Mrs. Madden, who is elderly and old-fashioned, quite disapproved when Aunt Meg and I agreed to honor your request. However, please know that your Miss Caroline is kept safely under our wing and will remain so until your return. As well, your man Robert has been given our protection. We eagerly await your arrival. Eleanor Pike."
I reread both letters several times until the words blurred. My half-sister Eleanor's short note told me little, but what seemed clear was that I needed to get to Williamsburg as soon as possible. But first, there was Pam. The next afternoon, as I rode again to see Addie at Southwood, I decided that if I were to encounter Bill Thomas, I would override Mr. Spencer's warning. Though I didn't doubt his words were true, I believed that when it came to money, every man had a tipping point, and I meant to offer a purse that Bill Thomas could not refuse. Pam and I needed to leave as soon as possible. On my arrival, Addie had the chessboard set up, but I spent most of our game lost in my own thoughts.
"Mr. Burton, it's your turn," Addie finally scolded.
I forced myself to focus on the chess game. "Sorry, sorry," I mumbled, and picked up a pawn to make a quick move.
"Oh, we might as well stop playing," she pouted.
"Why?" I asked.
"Look at what you did. You are intentionally letting me win. And before, when I said that I was coming home on Sunday, you didn't say anything kind."
"I didn't? Forgive me, Miss Adelaide," I said. "Of course, it will be wonderful to have you home again. I'm having one of those days when I can't seem to get my feet on the ground." She tilted her head to look at me.
"I'm surprised to learn that about you. You were always so sure of yourself."
"It is all a fine act, Miss Adelaide," I said.
You mustn't feel bad, she said. Even I have days when I don't feel myself.
Is that right? I teased.
Yes, especially since Mother...
Her eyes welled up.
I miss her, you know, but I daren't say so. Father and Patricia are both...